Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. So nice to be with you. Thanks for spending some time with all of us here at Tectonic, me and all the other listeners. We have a great conversation today. I'm going to be speaking with Daniel Solove, who is a professor at the George Washington University Law School. He's got a new book out called On Privacy and Technology, which I found fascinating and really an accurate summary of the relevant issues that face us right now when we're talking about privacy, and especially the threats to our privacy and the degradation, the continual degradation of our privacy at the hands of technology companies and their government partners. So a little bit more about Daniel Solove you might find interesting. Solove is the author of over 10 books and 100 articles, and he's often cited in the field of law and technology. In fact, he's the most cited law professor in that field. So this is an example of a guest. I try to get guests for the show who are experts in their fields, because I can tell you, week to week, our privacy is under threat. These companies are doing X, Y, and Z to us. But I am just a generalist. I really appreciate when we can get a specialist, an expert who really knows their stuff in this topic to come and check what we're talking about on the show and make sure that we're actually being accurate and extend our thinking. And that's what Solove does in this conversation. So this book, again, is called On Privacy and Technology. It goes through what privacy is, why privacy matters, and we talk in the conversation about why our privacy continues to be degraded. Of course, the fact is it is being compromised, but it's interesting to ask why. What is the root cause? And in particular, we might wonder who or what is the villain here? I mean, what's really causing the destruction of our privacy? And you'll hear in this interview, Solove gives an interesting answer that I would not have guessed. And he will defend that answer, and he will describe why he gave such an unusual, what I found to be an unusual answer, which is also explored in the book. Let's go ahead and listen to this interview now. By the way, if you want links to Daniel's book and his site and some other resources I may talk about after the interview, go to the playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Find the Daniel Solove episode and click that playlist link. And now let's go ahead and listen to this interview with Daniel Solove on Tectonic. Daniel Solove, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. You're a professor at the George Washington University Law School, and you're the most cited law professor in the field of law and technology, all of which is why I think people really should know about your new book called On Privacy and Technology. This is a short, very readable book that covers every major aspect of privacy in the digital age, highlighting many of the points I've tried to make on the show over the years. I want to start with a common reaction to privacy concerns. A lot of people still say, I don't care about privacy because I have nothing to hide. You write in the book that, quote, the nothing to hide argument is flawed at its foundation. Why is that?
It's flawed because it has a wrong view of what privacy is all about. Privacy is a lot more than what this notion of nothing to hide tries to get at. And the idea of nothing to hide means that privacy is about hiding things, and in particular about hiding bad things, and that the only people who would care about privacy are people who have bad things to hide. But there's a lot more to privacy than hiding things. Privacy is about the ability to protect one's identity. It's about the ability to stop intrusions into one's life or manipulative advertising or the use of one's name or likeness to promote something of other people. It involves the ability to understand what information is being gathered about you and how it's being used and who it might be shared with. So there's a lot of things that really have nothing to do with things that you may want to hide. And there are a lot of reasons that someone might not want to share information that also don't involve things that are discreditable or bad about a person. So could be that, you know, I just don't want someone else to know something because I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk about other things. I want to talk about privacy. I don't want to talk about something going on in my personal life. And it might not be because I'm embarrassed by it or it's anything wrong or criminal. It's just I don't want others to know about it, or I want to share it with some people, but not other people. And privacy is about the right of the individual to be able to make those choices. So that's why I think that argument's really faulty, because it makes a assumption about what privacy is that's just wrong. Privacy is about so much more.
You also write about the benefits of privacy not simply being for individuals, but being for society at large. You write that protecting individual privacy makes society a better environment, and that privacy is an essential foundation for a free and democratic society. It's sad to me that we have to dwell on this point, but here we are in this society with surveillance proliferating everywhere. Can you explain to us, Dan, why is privacy so important to a free and democratic society?
It's essential because if you look first at, you know, pretty much every totalitarian society, whether it be in reality, in history, or in fiction, the thing about totalitarian societies is they all have something in common, whether historically or even in literature, and that is they all attack privacy. And the reason why they want to eliminate privacy is that's where people are the most vulnerable. That is where people form their views, share their views, honestly think about things. It's the zone of freedom of thought and belief, which is really a foundation for any democratic society. It's the ability to read, consume ideas, share ideas, without having a coercive pressure or threat that by doing that, you risk harm, whether it be the government arresting you or prosecuting you or doing something bad to you or taking away rights or privileges or being ostracized or blacklisted from employment and other types of opportunities in everyday life. If you really want a democracy where people are free to vote, to decide their political future, you've got to let them have freedom of thought and belief. You've got to let them explore ideas. You've got to let them express ideas. And if they're not free to do that, then you really don't have a viable democracy at all. That's the basis of an authoritarian society. So this is why privacy is so important to protect and why it's so important to democracy. You know, there's no surprise that, you know, we see so many great technological innovations and scientific breakthroughs and discoveries and so much great knowledge created and medical breakthroughs that have occurred in the United States because we have those protections, and that allows people to be free to do these types of things without having to be concerned or worried about the government or some other terrible consequences from other people. And this has been, I think, one reason why countries have been successful, societies have been successful, is when they protect these types of things. Unfortunately, I think we're entering an age, a dark age, where those lessons are being lost. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, I see the future right now is not very bright. I think that, you know, the amount of, you know, discoveries and innovation and all the things that kind of have made, you know, this country great are being destroyed. And we're seeing the kind of authoritarian, totalitarian style views come back. And generally, you know, authoritarian, totalitarian societies have contributed nothing to humanity or human history other than misery. They have not contributed great art. The only great literature they've contributed is literature in opposition to them. They have contributed nothing because they're about nothing. They're about power and they're about hatred and they're about oppression. And that's exactly why they want to stifle privacy, and they stifle also with it all the great things that can come out of a society. So that's how I see the relationship between privacy and society.
I was interested to see how you identified the root cause of our privacy problems. You write, quote, "If there's a villain in the story, it's the law's role." And later you write, "In the loss of privacy, the primary culprit is the legal scaffolding of the modern information economy." Now, Dan, people might be surprised to hear a law professor saying that the threats to our privacy are coming from the law.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate, but it's true. I think often people will blame tech companies. They're very easy to villainize because they are doing villainous things. But that doesn't actually mean that they are villains. I kind of see companies like sharks. They are built and designed to make a profit. Corporations are incredibly efficient machines at doing whatever they're incentivized to do. And that's how they're structured. The mistake that I think the law makes all the time is to somehow assume that companies operate outside the laws of economics, that a machine built to achieve an incentive is going to suddenly not do that. They're going to essentially break the laws of economics. Gravity will go the opposite direction, and corporations will just be nice and be good. But they're not going to be good. They're going to be amoral. We should never expect them to be good. The only way that we're going to get companies to do what is good, right, just, fair, whatever we want them to do, is we have to incentivize them to do it. And unfortunately, the law incentivizes them to be bad. And then they're bad. And then we're like, oh my God, I can't believe these companies are so terrible. Well, they're terrible because we've incentivized them to be terrible. We've created the wrong incentives. And that's the lesson that I really wanted to impart in the book, is that the lesson, we need to finally wake up to the fact that if we want to protect privacy, we want to rein in the tech companies and what they're doing, we've got to create the right incentives. The law often says, oh, we'll just like give consumers rights and then it's up to the consumer. We'll put the onus on the consumer to protect themselves. And that doesn't work. And I spent a lot of part of the book talking about why that doesn't work. The only thing that works is you got to hold companies accountable and you got to create the right incentives. That means if they do what you want them to do, they get a reward. If they don't do what you want them to do, they get the stick. Carrots and sticks. That's how it works. It's something that has worked really, you know, we have, you know, centuries of historical experience to prove this, to show this. But for some reason, policymakers seem to keep forgetting this lesson when it comes to the law. And this is why we have what we have, because the law has allowed it. It has actually not only ignored the problems, but it's actually facilitated it. And companies still actually have the incentive to do the wrong thing.
In addition to misaligned incentives, you bring up a problem that exists in the courts today. You write that courts routinely sympathize with big data companies And then you gave this one example, which I, of course, I believe it since you wrote it, but it's just hard to believe. You say, in one case, a credit reporting company falsely stated that a person went bankrupt. And then I guess the person tried to sue, obviously. And then you continue, the court rejected the person's lawsuit because, quote, mistakes can happen. When a company processes an enormous volume of information, which I think is a pretty ridiculous response, saying, oh, well, because this credit company was processing so much data, they said you went bankrupt and maybe it helped ruin your life, but it's not really their problem. They're doing a lot of work here.
Yeah, and I think that that's often the case. When you look at the courts, they are incredibly sympathetic to the plight of the companies and the harm to the companies. Like, oh my, it's so harmful that a company should have to spend a little bit of extra money to make sure its data is accurate or to make sure it's not harming people, because that's expensive. And, you know, that's gonna hurt the company because they're gonna make, you know, maybe a cent less of profit per shareholder. Oh my gosh, ouch, 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 the pain. On the other hand, when it comes to the consumer, courts seem to be oblivious to the harm to the consumer. So people get, you know, their information shared improperly and they're getting all sorts of unwanted solicitations and mail and whatever. And the courts are like, big deal. You know, someone's information's incorrect in their credit report. No problem. You know, the most egregious example of this, and I mean, you think these are hard to believe and you think that case is hard to believe, but there's a Supreme Court case decided in the past few years that's so absurd, like it's almost like if I wrote it in fiction, people wouldn't believe it. And it's that, you know, a credit reporting agency falsely labeled people as terrorists because what they did was they just did a name match. And so if your name matched a terrorist, and they didn't bother to do any further investigations, they didn't do anything to check to see, you know, whatever. So if your name matched a terrorist name, so if there's a terrorist named, you know, John Smith, and your name is John Smith, you're labeled a terrorist. That's all the credit reporting agency did. They just assumed that you must be the terrorist John Smith. Everybody agreed that this is against the law. So it was a violation of the law, because the law said you have to have good practices and procedures for verifying accuracy. So it's clearly against the law. But the court said that being labeled a terrorist in your report is not harmful.
What?
No harm.
What? How can they say that?
Well, they said because if it's not disclosed to anyone, then it's just in your report and it's not harmful. Now, I think this is ridiculous because, you know, if I'm about to go and, yeah, I find my dream home and I want to get a mortgage and I'm about to get the mortgage and I pull my credit report and I see that it lists me as a terrorist, I'm not going to apply it for the mortgage. I'm going to hold off and, you know, freak out and try to clean up this mess. In the meantime, the house goes away, you know, someone else buys, you know, it's gone. There's no harm there. Now, I think there's clearly harm, but the court is fixated on, well, it's not harmful unless it's actually disclosed to somebody else and then they do something to you. But I think it's so wrong and it's so absurd. But the court, again, is protecting the credit reporting agency. And the thing that's so ridiculous is it's not like this is not an honest mistake. This is just an egregious violation of law for something they should have known better. They deliberately, they knew, it's not like their lawyers somehow, this is like a question of gray area where lawyer, you know, any lawyer who made it through law school, even lawyers who took like 30 times to pass the bar, if they're a lawyer at these places, they would know that this is not a valid thing to do under the law. So it doesn't take Einstein to figure this out. So it's clear it's a violation. It's pretty clear they did it. And it's not like oops, we didn't know. They know, and they just, it's cheaper because they don't have to spend money to actually verify the thing. And the court backs them up. The incentive the court's saying is, go ahead, break the law. There are no consequences because we're just going to say there's no harm, so people can't sue. The harm that you caused to people, you don't have to pay for. That's what the law's getting wrong.
Well, we could do a separate conversation, Dan, where I could ask you a bunch of questions about why the courts are so aligned in favor of the corporations rather than the consumers. But that I feel like that would take us a little too far off track. I want to stick with your book on privacy and technology. So for next time. But you just mentioned a problem of a credit reporting agency putting in incorrect and harmful information into someone's credit file, their dossier. Now I want to bring up a separate issue, which I think is just as important, which is when data is inferred. This is something that I've tried to explain on this show a number of times over the years, but you really describe this expertly. I was happy to come across this. You write, quote, "Inference involves the analysis of personal data to glean new facts about individuals." Okay, so that's what inference is. Basically, it means that a company, let's say a retailer, can look at your purchase history or your location history or whatever and draw some conclusions about you that you might not want them to know. And that goes in your dossier. The problem is that, as you write, privacy law often focuses on the collection of data rather than the generation of data through inference. So, Dan, can you explain why is that so dangerous for privacy laws not to address inferred data?
Many privacy laws, in fact, the majority, really are based, you know, try to put a lot of the onus on people. And they say, well, you know, it's up to you to determine whether or not you should share your information with companies. And, you know, if you don't want them to collect certain data or have certain data or use certain data, then don't give it to them. You know, it's your control. You know, we're going to give you the control. And I think this is, I don't think people can really figure this out. And I think inference is a big reason, because I could say, you know, I'm okay with a supermarket knowing that I like to drink Diet Coke and I prefer these types of foods and these brands, but I don't want them to know my political beliefs. I don't want them to know information about my health. But the problem is that, you know, inferences can be made about my health and about my political beliefs and about a lot of other things, about my religion, based on these purchases. You know, you can look at what people buy and you can figure out, you can probably make some pretty good inferences about religion. You could probably make inferences about health, depending on the kinds of products that people are buying. And you can also make inferences about politics. These days, everything has politics. I never thought, like, you know, a pillow has politics, but, you know, now my pillow guy. So there's a great story, a real story, and actually happened a while ago that I think really drives home this point about inference. And that's something that happened at Target more than 10 years ago. Target wanted to figure out who was pregnant among its female customers before the baby was born, because they wanted to start sending out ads for products early on in the pregnancy. And so it developed an algorithm that figured out, based on a person's purchases, whether or not they were pregnant, and then started sending these ads. And in the story, there was this incident where a father of a teenage girl went to Target and started to complain and says, "I don't understand why we're getting all these baby ads. You know, nobody's pregnant." And it turns out, well, in fact, his teenage daughter was pregnant and she hadn't told him yet. Pregnancy is a sensitive data topic. It's about health. And people shopping at Target are not, you know, telling them about health. Target could have said, "Are you interested in telling us whether or not you're pregnant or not?" But they didn't do that. Instead, they secretly analyzed the data to figure this out. And that's a big problem, because the whole premise of the privacy laws is that the consumer is supposed to decide what information they share with the company. That's what the companies say. Like, you know, you are the one choosing what you share with us. So then if they say that and then turn around and behind a consumer's back go and analyze data of their purchases. Then the thing that's even worse about this case is the kind of data that can give rise to the inferences is rather surprising and unexpected. So it turned out that the data that revealed pregnancy, the pattern that the algorithm discovered, is that people who bought cotton balls and unscented products had a very high correlation of being pregnant. These are things that people can't figure out. It's just like, okay, if I buy cotton balls, then suddenly I'm going to be in my file. It's going to say I'm pregnant. So these are really big problems, and the law just does not address this at all. It provides hardly any limit on what companies can do to make inferences about me based on that information. And it can start generating information about anything about me, health, religion, politics, race, anything.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We're halfway through my interview with Dan Solov. Try that again. Dan Solov, the author of On Privacy and Technology. This is a fascinating book that goes over the many, many problems we're facing as our privacy is degraded and compromised by digital technology, especially that inference issue that he was just talking about. I found that really interesting, and he stated it well. If you want more information on Dan Solov, his book, and his other writings, go to the Tectonic playlist, tectonic.fm, and click the playlist link for today's show. And now let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview with Dan Solov here on Tectonic. Speaking of companies saying to consumers, it's your choice, it's your choice. Another problem you bring up is the idea of consent. And here I'm talking about the terms and conditions that we all get when we get a new app or we sign up for an account on a website or something. And you always have to click that you have read the terms and conditions and you agree to them, which of course is a lie because no one has read them. And if they have, no one understands them, which is by design. And so this is why you call consent a complete fiction. What can companies get away with using this fiction of consent?
Pretty much anything, because in the law, and this is another reason why the law fails so badly and why I think it's the villain, is that the law basically says that consent is a kind of great blessing. It legitimizes almost anything, and it confers this rather potent power to do whatever you want. So if a company gets your consent to collect your data, to use your data, it can do it. Consent allows so much that can happen. A company, well, we got your consent, you accepted it, therefore now we're allowed to do it. And it gives them legitimacy. They can go and do it and they can say, well, you know, if someone says, well, why'd you do that? And like, oh, you said yes. And there's so many things that people can consent to that could be harmful to them, that could be against their own interests. But, you know, when the law says you agreed and therefore it's okay because you agreed to it. This is the problem. If the consent that we're getting is bogus, just a total fiction, then companies are getting their power and legitimacy. It's also based on a total fiction. And that's what most of this is. You know, that you can put anything in those terms of service. And we're seeing that time and again today. And courts have kind of taken traditional contract law and they've twisted it into a pretzel to try to make these things allowable. So used to be in traditional contract, you had to have a real bargaining and a meeting of the minds. So you'd actually have to understand what the terms are and what you're agreeing to. These days, you know, you're just privacy notices put up there. You don't have to look at it. And you just by going to the site, you've agreed to it. Or they'll throw up a thing like, here's 50 screens of this legalese whatever agreement. and you have to click accept. So, you know, no one, like, the accept button's on the first page. So you just click accept. No one reads these things. If you read them, you wouldn't even understand them. But buried in them are all sorts of terms. Terms that say, hey, guess what? You waive your right to sue if you're harmed. Or you agree to all these other things that you have no interest in agreeing to, had no idea you're agreeing to, but now are bound to. And this is what we get with every single thing that we do, because now everything has terms. You go back in history, you know, go back to, like, you know, 1950. You didn't go to a website to buy every little thing. You know, you go and you buy, you want to buy a pack of gum. You just went to the store, you paid, you know, whatever a pack of gum would cost, a nickel, I don't know. But, and you got your pack of gum and that was it. There wasn't personal data collected. You didn't sign away your firstborn child to buy a pack of gum. These days, you go to buy a pack of gum, you have to go to a website. There's all sorts of terms. You have to agree to all these terms. You have all these terms on your credit card. All this personal data is collected. You know, cookies are put on your machine, all sorts of stuff. And you've agreed to all this, all these contracts for everything. You can't do anything, go to any site or perform any function in life today without sometimes the terms of service. So you're drowning in contracts. Everything you do, contract this, contract that. If you call these things contracts, I actually don't think they're contracts. I think they're basically garbage and they shouldn't be enforced. They are meaningless stuff and the court should just kind of ignore it all. Ultimately, what I argue in the book is that I don't think we can go to a world where we abandon the idea of consent, because, you know, we don't want the government just telling us, you know, what we can and can't do. So I think ultimately, you know, people have to be able to choose. The problem is that people don't have time to study all the details about privacy. They don't have time to become privacy experts.
On that point, Dan, you write that a majority of people falsely believe that when a website has a privacy policy, it won't share their personal data. I remember reading Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. She was on the show a number of years ago. She wrote in that book that they shouldn't be called privacy policies. They should be called exploitation policies.
Yeah, I think they're written by lawyers to give companies the biggest leeway they can to do whatever they want to do. That's the system that we have, because we throw so much onus on the consumer to figure it all out. And I think that's wrong. I think in other areas we've learned better. So, you know, if I go to the supermarket and I go to buy some milk, I don't have to become an expert on milk production. I don't have to become an expert on pasteurization. I don't have to go and research the farms that the milk came from to determine, will the milk kill me or not? Because in the past, it used to be that the milk could kill you. They used to put formaldehyde in the milk and all these babies died. And then people were like, why are the babies dying? Well, maybe because you're putting poison in the milk just to make it taste sweet because it had gone sour. But ultimately, we realized more than a century ago that you kind of need some laws to regulate and protect against food. And so we created laws that forced disclosures and forced certain safety standards on food and didn't put the onus on consumers to figure out, you know, if I buy this milk, am I going to die? It was up to the, you know, there's someone looking out for the safety of milk. I mean, sadly, now it looks like today with our head of HHS that, I guess, he doesn't believe in pasteurization. I don't know. But I mean, we're going in crazy land right now. But in a normal, non-crazy world, we've realized, like, okay, you know, milk is pasteurized and the consumer doesn't need to be an expert on it. Unfortunately, when it comes to technology, it's like all those lessons are forgotten and it's buyer beware. Like suddenly, okay, consumers have to become an expert on privacy and have to become an expert on these technologies, have to become an expert on AI. And the problem is they're not going to be able to be an expert on AI. They're not going to be able to get the kind of information they need to make the decision, which is really the ultimate decision that consumers are going to make when they use technology, is what are the benefits? What are the potential harms to me? And are the benefits worth the risks? That's what they're going to determine. If I share this information, what am I going to get from it? And then what could possibly go wrong? What could be the harms to me? And unfortunately, you know, people will just do not know enough to be able to make that determination. And it's not because people, even if I spent the next 10 years training someone on everything I know about privacy, the problem is that even I can't make that determination because I don't know enough, and not enough is disclosed in the privacy notice telling me, oh, we love your privacy, trust us, we're all about trust because we like to write the word trust on our website. You know, we give you reasonable data security. But what does that mean? I want to know, you know, give me time to interview the privacy officer at the company. I want to know what your vendors are like. What kind of process do you have to regulate probably hundreds or thousands of other companies that have the data that you're sharing the data with? What kind of security do you have? How good is it? Are you training people about this? What's the budget of the privacy office? What does your privacy impact assessment look like? How often do you do them? What do you do if you see an issue? How well do you respond to it? I'd want to know all sorts of things internally. How does your AI work? You know, not just the algorithm, but I need to know all the data that it's trained on so I can see what kind of results it's going to give me, so then I can see how it's going to come out, but so that I can understand how your technology works.
And all of that for a pack of chewing gum. You write in the book about an idea called privacy self-management. And that's basically the idea we hear a lot, that if you want to protect your privacy, you need to go and set this privacy setting, and you need to be careful with this privacy policy and take these actions. And you say in the book, what you've just been arguing here, Dan, that this process is ultimately futile. People cannot be expected to do this on their own. And I just want to read this one short passage from near the end of the book where I thought you had kind of an amusing disclosure of your own experience being asked about this. You write, "After discussing with me the terrifying threats to privacy by new technologies, countless interviewers ask me what individuals can do to protect their privacy. They want to end on a positive note and give people a sense of hope and empowerment. But I hate this question. I could rattle off a few small things people can do, but these things are futile. They create the illusion that individuals can meaningfully protect themselves if they just work hard enough. Instead, I prefer to tell people the truth. No matter how hard they try, they can't even come close to protecting themselves." And you go on to what your answer is, what we should do. But I just wanted to stop there, Dan, because I thought that was so well done. And I promise I'm not going to ask the same question. What can we do? Because I think this is the right point for us to underline here, that it's a fool's errand to tell people to manage their own privacy.
Absolutely. I think that I'm almost tempted to say, you know, if you really want to protect your privacy, send me a check for $1,000. But there's really very little that people can do that, you know, will make them feel like that will give them the kind of safety and assurance that they really want. And that's the problem, that the law has to do these things, that the law has to set up the right incentives. The law does set up the right incentives, it can work. And we see that with car safety. It used to be, you know, cars were not very safe. And now it's, you know, you can't put out a car that's just going to blow up on you. So I can buy a car and I don't have to become an expert on cars. I don't have to test the cars. I can just buy the car and I know it's going to have a minimum safety. And there are cars that are more safe or less safe. And I can read various magazines and reports to get a safer car, but there's basic minimum safety. And you know, if the car does, something does go wrong, I can sue. And courts will say, yes, you're harmed. And you know, there's a suit. So the companies know if they make a car that's not safe, it will either fail an inspection or it's going to cause harm and then they're going to be accountable. Problem is, with technology, it's not that way. Companies know they can just get away with it. They can do it. No one's going to look at it. They'll put it out there. And if it harms people, the courts are going to come in and help them out. They're going to say, we feel your pain. It's going to be costly. You did this awful thing. You hurt all these people. And we feel for you because we don't like the fact you might make a little less profit. The company is going to say, well, great. You're telling us. Keep acting this way. Keep being reckless. Keep doing this. But you know, they think that somehow the consumer is, you know, like the onus, oh, well, if I just do this and this and this, I'm protected. No, it's just then consumers feel guilty. They feel like they're to blame. Oh, I should have done this or I should have done that. If I only took my Social Security number and I locked it in a thicker safe, and then I put the safe in another safe, and then I put that in even a bigger safe, and I have like 10 safes and 10 locks, and that somehow I'm okay. No. And I think that's just trying to shift the blame and shift the accountability and try to make the consumer feel like, oh, if only I did this, I'd be okay. But that's just part of this myth and part of this lie. At the end of the day, the only way our privacy is going to be protected is if companies have the right incentives. They have the incentive to not harm people.
And you're right that that incentive is going to come from policymakers doing something meaningful in privacy law. Here, I want to turn briefly to the privacy laws that are on the books now, which you, I'm just paraphrasing, you're not very impressed with what we have in the U.S. right now. A couple of little things here and there, a couple of states have things. But what you write is that privacy law has taken a wrong turn in offering individuals control over their own data. You write that it's a well-meaning impulse, but it's not going to work. You write, the law instead should attempt to bring the collection, use, and disclosure of personal data under control. And I thought that was so well stated that we have to stop putting it on the consumers, saying, hey, look, now the law has given you even more options to control your privacy. No. We have to regulate the data, whether it's coming from companies or government agencies. We have to bring that under control. As you say, the collection of the data, the use of the data, the disclosure of the data has to be the focus of the regulation.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I've been really hammering the point of, you know, just the onus on the consumer just doesn't work. So what does work? And that is that policymakers have to make some hard choices. They need to make the right kind of accountability. And that means, I think, at the minimum, if someone is harmed from the collection and use of their data, the company should be held accountable and should pay for that harm. And if the law shifts the harm to the companies, then the companies have to internalize that and address that. And if they, you know, it costs them. So if it were cost, in the case I talked to you about earlier, about the credit reporting agency that mislabeled people as terrorists, if it were to cost them a lot of money, if by doing that it costs them, guess what? They're not going to do it. Because when the lawyer says, you know, you shouldn't do this, and if you do it, guess what? You're going to get sued and you're going to pay this gigantic penalty, this gigantic amount of damages. Then they'd be like, okay, actually, you know, that those damages are a lot more than if we just spend a little bit of money and better check the names. And then we'll get a better result. And the law needs to mandate that. And if the law doesn't, well, yeah, the companies are just going to make the economic decision, what's cheapest? And they'll do the cheapest thing. So that's what the law needs to start waking up and doing. And it seems like for some reason, it's really uncomfortable for courts and policymakers to tell companies, be accountable, to hold them accountable. They really struggle in doing that. They just don't want to apply basic economic theories to companies. And I think that's the problem. And the state laws and the laws in the United States, generally, they all do mostly rely on just, well, we'll just require disclosures that nobody reads, and then we'll just put it all on the consumer to somehow protect themselves.
Well, I can just hope that more people will read this book to understand what the risks to people's privacy are in today's technology and what the harms are, and ultimately what we need to be asking policymakers to do to protect all of us. The book is called On Privacy and Technology by you, Daniel Solove. Dan, thanks again so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next 10-ish minutes. We just heard my interview with Daniel Solove, professor at the George Washington University Law School, the most cited law professor on the topic of privacy and technology. And appropriately enough, his most recent book is called On Privacy and Technology. If you want more links to find the book and find more from Dan Solove, go to the playlist. It is located at the Tectonic website, which is techtonic.fm, and then click the playlist link for the Daniel Solove episode. There's a lot there, and in the remaining minutes of the show, I might get a chance to go through a little bit of it. But I want to read one other quote from Dan's book, because I didn't get around to asking him about it, and I thought it was an interesting angle on this topic of privacy and technology. If you've listened to the show a bit, you know that I will often ask my guests, usually sometime around the end of the interview, what else should we be reading, or what are you reading that you're inspired by, or what have you read in the past that we should know about? Something about other books that we should know about. And it was interesting that on page two of Dan's book, page two, he writes the following: "Are we doomed to watch helplessly as technology turns our world into a terrible blend of Franz Kafka's The Trial, George Orwell's 1984, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale? Can anything be done to save us from a dystopian world without privacy?" And he goes on to write about the importance of literature. I believe that Dan says in the book that he majored in literature in college, and he still believes in the power of literature to help enrich our understanding of the world. And those are just a few of the books that obviously he's recommending to us as classics in dystopian fiction. And I would agree. And if you want some more recommendations, you can go through the past Tectonic episodes. There have been a number of fiction books that have touched on privacy and dystopia that would further enrich our understanding for anyone who reads it. And the follow-up on the book's topic comes from one of the links on the playlist. Now, Dan, as I said, has written 10 books, and he's written dozens of articles. And another thing that he's posted, very impressive, every year he posts a list of what he considers the most influential or the most important to read books on the subject of privacy. And you can see there's on the playlist there at tectonic.fm, there is his list of books on privacy and security, and then there is a separate guide, a downloadable PDF, which lists over 400 privacy-related books. And the guide actually is really interesting because it breaks up the recommendations by decade. And so, get this, there's this book, okay? It's called The Death of Privacy. And Dan writes in his brief description, this book discusses computerization of records and Automated Data Processing. It's by the author Jerry Rosenberg. And here's the punchline to all this. The book, The Death of Privacy, came out in 1969. So this idea of privacy dying at the hands of digital technology and the companies behind it is not a new idea. I mean, his recommendations, if I'm scrolling up in this PDF, I'm looking at the earliest book that he recommends. It's a book by Myron Brenton called The Privacy Invaders. That came out in 1964. So we're talking about over 60 years. People have been documenting the harms to our privacy and warning us what could happen if we let these corporations run unchecked with our data. And that is exactly what's happened. And of course, in the last, let's say, 10 years, it's just accelerated. When we see this consolidation of power and technology might and the sheer amount of money and wealth concentrated in these five or so companies, what I call big tech. And now increasingly, the partnerships, the deep partnerships that these companies have formed with the U.S. government, our privacy is being compromised at a greater rate than ever before. I mean, much worse than these authors in the 1960s could have imagined. But there is some hope. There is some hope, and it comes in the form of what Dan is writing about in this book on privacy and technology. Because there are people out there, like Dan and others, other authors that he's pointing us to, who are saying, this is what's happening, pay attention, and here are the next steps if we want to take back our privacy, and which, by the way, by extension, that means if we want to take back the idea of democracy even existing in this world. Because, as he said at the beginning of the interview, the stakes here are not just whether someone knows what you bought at Amazon or something, although don't shop at Amazon. It's societal. The stakes are societal in nature. Are we going to have a democracy that endures? And so if we want that, here are the next steps. We have to get involved. We have to elect elected representatives who care about this. We have to get in touch with people who have the ability through their position, often in the government, to do something on behalf of the citizens. Because, as he said, these companies are never going to behave unless the right incentives are put in front of them. And we could do a whole show about what those incentives should be. Monetary fines. I think, as I've said over the years, it would be so helpful if there were criminal penalties and we could see a perp walk, if we could see Silicon Valley CEOs in handcuffs walking into a police car. That would be so helpful to underline the importance of these companies not compromising our privacy and not trying to destroy our democracy for profit, which is exactly what's happening. So thanks again to Dan Sola for being on the show. Friends, you have comments or pointers or book recommendations for me, you can reach me at mark@wfmu.org. Again, the website for the show is tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And go look at those links for today's episode, because you have a reading list now of over 400 books going back the past 60-plus years. Thanks to Dan for putting that together for us. And I do have a little bit of homework for you. As always, until next time, friends, I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Please stay tuned to my friend Dave Mandel, who you just can't handle. He's got a show called It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. For our outro today, we've got a song that I believe was recommended to me by brother Daniel Blumen. Thank you, Daniel. It's a song by the Metronomes called A Circuit Like Me. And friends, please don't be a circuit. Be a human. Fight for democracy. I'll see you next time.
binary. A body so clean, titanium first degree. Geometric bliss, imperfect symmetry.
And that sweet sound means it's time for another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. This show, hosted by myself, Dave Mandel, comes to you every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for joining me. And yes, we play, all of us, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. And if you don't know what that means, stick around and you'll learn soon enough. We're going to start tonight's show with some new wave, let's call it, a group called the Cardiacs. I tip my hat to the person, as usual. I don't remember his name. I'm just terrible that way. But a listener pointed this out to me a week or two ago, and a group, the Cardiacs, who I vaguely remember, English band, early 80s, and he specifically, this mysterious unnamed listener, in particular, pointed me to this track, which is called Gibber and Twitch. And it's interesting. It is extremely proggy and extremely punky or new wave-ish. There's even some ska elements, the time being 1984, and you had to inject a little bit of ska into pretty much anything you did. So again, this will be the Cardiacs, English band, 1984, a track from an album called The Seaside. And I've seen, I don't accept this. I don't think this is standard, but I have seen in at least one place this particular style of music referred to as pronk, a combination of prog and punk. And sure, why not? Anyway, this is the Cardiacs.
Thank you. now, but then again.
Oh no! Isn't it good? Why do I feel so misunderstood? Could it be that I'm feeling? Look at my finger, it's just for a moment. Look at me, woo. No wonder I'm feeling bored all the time. Could it be that I'm wrong? I'm not on the bed then again.
Oh, it would be nice for everyone.
Up. Or is it that I'm dreaming? Look at my finger, why it's just for a moment. Look at me, what am I feeling bored all the time? Could it be that I'm wrong, I'm not, I'm not, but then again.
Oh, it would be nice for everyone. It would be nice for everyone. Oh, what a lovely way to be. Oh, what a lovely way to be. It would be nice for everyone.
Just for a moment. Could be more. No wonder I'm feeling bored all the time. Could it be that I'm wrong, I'm not, I'm not bad then again.
Where has that song been all my life? The Cardiacs and a track called Gibber and Twitch from an album called The Seaside, 1984. Heavy prog action going on in that track, which, again, I've heard them referred to as pronk, prog punk, a portmanteau. I don't endorse that word. I don't know. It just sounds kind of funny to me. And there's also some ska. How would you, like, prank ska or something? I don't know. How would you describe that? Anyway, Cardiacs, 1984. What a great song. We're going to stick around that time period a little bit longer, 6 or 7 minutes longer, maybe 6 minutes longer. I'm going to play. This was another listener recommendation. I am eternally grateful and ready, willing, and able to give credit to our wonderful listeners for sending recommendations now and then. I get recommendations all the time on our comments board and by email and by.